It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth. Alaska's mountains speak to different people in different ways. To some, they say climb. And enough people have heard that voice to develop a large and active climbing community in Anchorage, a community that spans generations. That's the topic of today's show, with a guest who pioneered climbing here and a younger climber who's pulling together this community in a new way. The conversation is about why and how climbers challenge themselves with Alaska's mountains, and also about the experience affecting them, helping them grow, and connecting them with others like themselves. It's a deep topic and worth thinking about. My guests today are both mountain climbers. Charlie Cicera has been part of this Alaska mountain climbing community kind of for a long time and still is, and I'm sure you've got a lot of great stories of your own, and you've heard a lot of great stories, right, Charlie?
Yeah, there's a few.
Yeah, and also a second-generation character, because his father, Chuck, was a pioneer aviator in Alaska who was on the show last year, and we'll link to that show on today's show at outdoorexplorer.org. And Evan Phillips, younger man, but also has his own accomplishments to his name, and Evan is starting a new podcast that's going to try to bring this climbing community together and record some of the stories, and I just want to hear you tell about that, Evan, and because that sounds really exciting and something kind of new for Alaska.
Yeah, so the project is called The Fern Line. It's a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers, and I've decided to do the first season is going to be 12 episodes, and it's framed up as stories from Alaska's mountains. So I'll be doing interviews with people like Charlie Cicera, kind of crossing from some of the older generation of climbers to the newer generation of climbers. And basically what I do is just weave taped interviews with music that I write and produce, and then weave some narration in there too, just to craft an hour-long episode.
Yeah, so you'll have to explain the title, The Fern Line. It's not F-E-R-N like ferns in the woods. It's F-I-R-N.
Yeah. So basically, it's a geologic term, I guess. It's where the snow line is on a glacier. Where I don't know the technical way to describe it, but it's, you know, as the snow melts in the summertime, there's snow above the fern line, and then it's melted below the fern line.
So maybe. Yeah.
Yeah.
I always like to keep things a little bit abstract and artistic.
Well, tell me, why is it important to you, Evan, to do this? Why do we need to? I mean, mountain climbing is thought of, I think, popular as sort of like a solitary experience, but actually, there's a big community aspect to it.
Yeah, well, a couple things for me is, I grew up in Alaska. I started climbing when I was around 17 years old, and it was a transforming experience for me. And when I first got into climbing, I was really influenced by the stories I'd read. And I loved reading climbing mountaineering literature, and I still do. So I have a personal interest in stories. Over the years, I have a lot of really close friends, and there's this community of people that I've been connected with over the years. They're some of the most interesting people I've ever met in my life. I'm fascinated by what drives people to climb mountains, and kind of what people's motivations are. And, you know, also I just, the relationships that I've formed in the mountains are some of the strongest friendships and bonds that I have in my life. And I guess it's a way for me to honor that.
Mm-hmm. It's great you're doing it. And I think what you just said was clicked for me, is that mountain climbing and a lot of outdoor activities are kind of story creation, right? You're going out and doing something that's going to make your life have the stories that make it interesting, you know? And so you're collecting some of those stories, and that seems really valuable. I mean, Charlie, tell me about how you became a mountain climber. I mean, part of it is, I think, you know, having also grown up in Alaska, as all three of us did, is you look out and you see these darn things and you wonder about climbing them, right? I mean, is that part of it?
Oh, absolutely. Well, the story I like to tell about that was, it was really my grandmother that got me going, and she would have this map on the world and tell stories about places. And I would have I'd be fantasizing, I'd be going to the Himalaya or to, you know, Asia or wherever it might be. And so But my grandfather and my uncles were linemen in the 50s, and so I imitated them, and I'd talked about this with Evan, but we had a lodge up at Big Lake called the Yacht Club, and I would take and nail literally 16-penny nails in the logs and string wire through the house, right? Wow. And climb all over. I just climbed on stuff, and it was just the, I just wanted it so bad. And then finally, it was, I think that the transition beyond trees and tree forts and that kind of stuff was seeing Pioneer Peak, and in the north face it's Pioneer Peak, and you know, thinking, you know, I want that, right? And uh-huh. So it was all I wanted for many, 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 many years. So that's, I mean, basically it came from living here and wanting, you know, to go further and explore further.
I wonder how many people have had that same experience looking at Pioneer Peak, because it stands out there like something that's just,
yeah.
just demanding yeah. to be climbed.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So you came from a family of real adventurers. I mean, that the stuff that you're parents did is amazing, with their sailing and driving around Africa right. and flying all over the place. Was that inspiring to you, intimidating to you? I mean, how did that affect your makeup, do you think?
It was, I think that they provided this atmosphere where it was anything was possible, right? And so and they weren't intimidated by trying new things, and so that approach, I think, is what came to my brother and I. But you know, my dad or none of them ever had any interest in doing what I was doing. So it was I was solely on my own. You know, it's like, yeah. You go for it.
Yeah, he told me this great story about he's flying his plane around Denali, which at that time we called McKinley, and flying over, I don't know what part of the mountain it was, but sort of flying over and seeing you. Do you know what I'm talking about?
There's he's flown over us several times, and it's been a really unique situation. And there's another story about the interaction between aviation and the development of climbing in Alaska and how important they are together. But you know, my parents there's two stories. We were on a Denali in the winter, and they were pretty high, couldn't see them. But on Deborah, they flew over, and they were just a couple hundred feet away. And it was just like, all I wanted, when I saw them go by, I knew who it was because I knew what date it was, and I could see their faces. And I'm thinking, you know, like, I'd rather be in the airplane. You know, because you have this attitude that you're, you know, a real tough guy until you see your mom.
Yeah, okay. And she's right there.
Right, yeah. But you can't go.
Well, I mean, let's get into that right away, because I think for people who are not mountain climbers, there's a little bit of a puzzle here, like, because frankly, so many of the mountain climbing stories you hear about something horrible, you know, it's like extreme cold, extreme hardship, we survived, some didn't, and then the question, like, well, why would you put yourself through that? Is amnesia a big part of it? Like, when you get back, you kind of forget about the bad parts? Or tell me what your
well,
take on that, Charlie.
I think that there's a, you know, you have a selective memory of some, when you're in the game and you're trying to, you know, do something new or try to push yourself. And, you know, but it's, I don't know how to answer that question, to tell you the truth.
Right. Yeah, why put yourself through it? Evan, yeah. Do you have an answer for that one?
Well, one of the things that Charlie and I talked about when we did an interview for the podcast is Charlie talked about, you know, the expression of climbing. And, you know, we talked and related to each other about it being, you know, when you go to climb a mountain, if you're a certain kind of climber, you see a line. There's a line on the mountain that looks aesthetic, that looks beautiful, and you want to take that line. And so I think part of it is, it's a creative expression, and everybody has their own motives. But I know for me, it was part being a creative person, part just wanting to see what's on the other side, you know. And you know, I remember having a light bulb moment when I was 17 years old. I was back at the end of a Klutna Lake, and I think it might have been like an Outward Bound group, and they were heading. It was these young people heading up to a Klutna Glacier, and I just remember seeing all the gear they had, and they told me where they were going, and it was like a light bulb moment. I said, "There's this whole other world. that you don't see right. in the city. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Charlie, it's like, I want to go see that world, you know, mm-hmm. and it just opened up the world to me personally.
And another version of that answer to that question is that, because I participated in the sport for, you know, 30 plus years, and so I grew up in it, and your motivations and you mature as a person, so that your mm-hmm. perspective of what you're doing evolves. And so there were different reasons that it, you know, a young person wanting to do it to, you know, through it. And I had an opportunity to talk about that once with David Stevenson at a presentation, and they were talking about what books were inspirational. And so in the beginning it was, I just wanted to do it. I wanted to know how. It was all about how to do it. And it was just focused on that. And then there were some books related to that. And then there was finding sort of your tribe, the people that relate to. And there were some books in that group as well. It was Demesson's Total Alpinism. It's a French guy. And it's got this amazing passages in it. And then later it was sort of as it matured, it was more of like, why are you doing it? And then, you know, there was some books in that genre, which was Feeding the Rat, and that was a story of this British climber. So you're doing the activity, but your interaction with the sport and the meaning to get out of it changes. And the first mm-hmm. bit of it, it's just like you're just consuming it like, you know, dog food. I want it, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's like, how can I get it done?
Yeah. Well, and I correct me if I'm wrong, but if it's something that you don't actually enjoy and you're just doing it to show off, you're probably not going to stick with it that long, right? Unless you've got the biggest ego in the world, because it's really hard and it's really uncomfortable.
They don't really make it. Yeah. People like that.
Yeah. I mean, at some level, there's got to be some joy in it, or you wouldn't stick with it. It's expensive, hard, dangerous, and uncomfortable a lot of the time.
Well, now, for me, if I have the choice of it, I still love the movement, and I want to go climb long, you know, rock climbs that are in more temperate zones, and, you know, and have that experience. I just love the movement and that experience, but, you know, mm-hmm. I don't want to be scared anymore.
Yeah, okay. It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about mountain climbing and the mountain climbing community in Alaska today. Charlie Cesar is with me, a very long time and very experienced climber, and Evan Phillips, who has started a new podcast to collect some of these Alaskan mountain climbing stories, which is going to be going online soon, called The Fern Line. And it has sort of taken on a little bit of a role of a convener of this mountain climbing community, which is great. You also, I believe, started the Trip Report, which is presentations that were done at the Taproot where folks come out and talk about their experiences, and Fill the Club, right? Because, you know, regardless of how good the presentation is, people have a hunger to be connected with other people who have this activity. When did you have that insight that this was something that a lot of people were going to be into?
I don't even know if I had a specific insight. At the time, I was, you know, was booking the events at the Taproot, so I was, you know, trying. I was being creative. I was thinking of, you know, what are some ways to, what is this space good for? And at the time, the space was good for that. I was like, well, you know, I've got all this community of people that I know that love to get together and hang out. They love hearing other people's stories, and they like to drink beer.
Right.
You know, so
perfect combination.
I mean, that's kind of how that came about. But for me, it's slideshows have always been kind of a part of the mountaineering culture that I've
totally
been a part of.
It.
So it's always been kind of a mountaineering thing. Oh, let's go to the
slideshow.
Sort
of going back to Brad Washburn, right? You know, the photography and the climbing are so interrelated, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so really, I mean, I just, that stuff happens for me because I enjoy it. And same with the podcast. I mean, I've been working in audio for a while, and I just enjoy these things, and that's really ultimately why I do it.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how new climbers get made, isn't it? Like, they know somebody who's doing it and sort of get, is that sort of how you guys pick this stuff up, and do you teach it to others?
Well, I think that's more common now, mm-hmm. Because when there wasn't anybody climbing or, you know, doing these activities when I was a kid. It was there wasn't anyone. So we just went, and, you know, we're living here in Anchorage, take the snow machine and drive up into the Chugach and just plod along and just do things.
Just find a mountain and climb.
Yeah, I mean, there was none of, so because we were in a, it was pretty isolated place, and there was...
And we're talking like 1960s?
Yes, and the 70s and that kind of stuff. And so there wasn't anything here. And I mean, there were people being active, but we didn't know them, didn't even know how to ask the question. I mean, when we went to Denali in the winter in 83, we didn't even know that the Park Service was closed. And so we never registered. We just flew in there, right? And we didn't know anything. We'd never been to the mountain. We hadn't seen the routes, or, you know, we just went. And so that exploratory perspective was, I mean, just like kids, because it was an extension of playing in the snow, going, you know, with snow machines and hockey and being kids and motorcycles and sledding and, you know, and having like Bill Spencer for in junior high school as your classmates. And, and so we were playing, and it was so we just went further and further and further, and it wasn't, and then we discovered, oh, all everybody else is, you know, it's there. But it was probably, you know, 5 or 6 years after I started the activity that I discovered any of the literature or any of there were other.
Well, what about the technology? I mean, the skis in those days were really pretty bad.
They're terrible.
A lot of equipment, didn't, like the avalanche gear didn't even exist yet.
No,
right?
No. I think that it was one of the advantages of starting up here is that we would just use sort of a gauge of your own courage to know when to come home, as opposed to, you know, learning a skill. And so we either would climb or do all this stuff on our own or with very minimal gear, no ropes, if we could, like I told Evan, if we could climb it, you could lead it. Which meant later, you know, you learn how to, we should put some protection in and have a thing. So it was really just an extension of the plane.
Did you take some risks in those days that you now look back on and think, well, I sure wouldn't want my kid doing that?
Yeah. This is, I had talked to some kids at East High School years ago, and I said, you wouldn't teach them how to drag race.
Right.
And this is, you know, and there were real serious consequences, but, you know, the foundation was built over being, you know, independent and, you know, self-sufficient in the woods, to the tree, you know, out to the, you know, jumping between trees and play. It's an extension of play. So we were, there was no, you know, break, now I'm becoming an astronaut or something.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. Do you think that the climbing culture is a lot different now?
Oh, yeah, because it didn't exist. And so now there's a community of people that are, you know, they got the gym has been real successful in giving people a way to become trained and become strong and learn, you know, the basics of stuff. And then there's organizations around it. And then there was the Valdez Ice Festival, and the MCA produced, you know, their festival at Matanuska Glacier. And so the community has just grown. And then people have gotten better, and there's more information. You got the avalanche forecasting, and so all this network of information and community is out there. And, you know, with the social media and the communications, it's easier to connect. But there's also, it's interesting, is you can see more segmentation in between people, and they're more specialized.
Yeah, more specialized, and people doing some, I think, amazing stuff that nobody ever would have thought of before.
Oh, yeah.
Some just incredible and stuff. Evan, now that having heard Charlie's story about what it was like in those days, tell me about what it was like when you were developing your climbing skills and where you got them.
Yeah, so I started getting into climbing in the mid-90s, probably around 1995. And it's interesting because I was seeking out people like Charlie back then. That like there had been a generation of climbers before me, and so as a kid, essentially, I mean, I looked up to people like Charlie. There's people like Steve Garvey and Jim Sweeney and Charlie Cicera and Carl Tobin and Roman Dial and all these people. I never climbed with any of them, but I would seek them out and I would talk to them, and you know, Charlie was we never climbed together, but like we were buddies back then. Mm-hmm. And Charlie was very encouraging of the things I was doing. And, you know, it was my community. But really, it was just me. It was like Charlie. I had a couple of partners that I climbed with. We were kids, and we were doing the same thing Charlie was doing. We were going out and testing ourselves and doing things that we wanted to do. And that usually required big approaches from the road,
No airplane.
No airplane, you know, and just going, finding a line on a contour map and going.
Yeah.
And
where did you, did you like develop skills by taking classes, talking to friends?
The first class I took a ice climbing class through UAA. And then I took another ice climbing class the next winter with Nick Parker at AMH. And then the summer after that, when I was 17, I did the Eklutna Traverse with UAA. So I did get some instruction. I learned glacier travel. I learned how to get people out of crevasses or get myself out of a crevasse if I fell. You know, I learned all the basic safety stuff. And, I was a cautious, careful, pretty smart climber. I took my time, and I turned around a lot. I failed a lot, but I learned from that too. And I was very fortunate in that sense that I was surrounded by a really supportive, pretty solid community of sharp people.
Yeah. By the 90s, there was a tremendous community and support, and the UAA outdoor program is gone now.
Yeah.
And that was a really strong piece of it. APU has taken that place a little bit.
Yeah. Those were very positive experiences for me, and you know, really helped me kind of get started onto doing my own stuff. It's like as soon as I did the Glacier class on Eklutna, then I could go up there on my own and start doing these climbs. And you know, believe me, back then you didn't see anybody when you went up there.
right
You know,
just following up on that, now backcountry and climbing stuff is exploding in popularity in a way that is just extraordinary, you know. And I'm interested in, Evan, you have, especially through your work, you have interaction with that culture, which is almost another generation following you. What do you see in terms of how that's changed?
That's just really echoing what Charlie said. I mean, the world is so connected now because of the internet. And, you know, if you post some pictures on the internet and say, I'm a climber, like, I guess you're a climber, you know? It's very different. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. In a lot of ways, it's a good thing. But there's just so many people doing it now. There's so much information. Like Charlie was saying, you know, some people just specialize in ice climbing. Some people just rock climb. Some people just boulder. I know for me, and I think for Charlie and for people who consider themselves to be mountaineers and alpinists, we did all those things to apply that to the mountains.
It's true.
And you know, for me, when I would go rock climbing or I'd go ice climbing or go mountain running, it was all training for the mountains. And I think that still exists, you know. I think it's kind of a purist way of looking at being an alpinist. Mm-hmm. You apply all those things. But to get back to your question, I think it's a good thing. Yeah, it's a good sport to be involved in.
Yeah.
I think that you and a lot of us, you sort of gravitate to what's available to you. And so the local, the mountains, and what's available right here are these big, you know, traverses, and to be on in the wilderness. You know, if you lived in a different part of the country, like in Kentucky, it would be, you know, rock climbing the Red River Gorge, or, you know, Red River Gorge, or different. You would be different. You know, it's what's available to you. And so, you know, the skiers and the climbers here, you know, they've got this playground which is just immense. And then, you know, but, you know, you wouldn't come to Alaska to become a great sport climber. It wouldn't happen, right? But it's still fun to climb in the gym and have that, you know, to have that strength and that kind of stuff. But this is a place for where it's, you know, still wild. And so that's where we went.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a tremendous energy, I think, that's going on right now, which is sort of a broadening out of what, when you were doing it, Charlie, it was a very narrow subculture.
Well, there was, I mean, when the Department of Transportation blasted the road out to Girdwood, we just waited on that first turn for it to freeze at, you know, this climb called Roadside Attraction. We just waited and we tried a couple times until it got thick enough. And that's, I mean, that was our first ice climb.
Right.
Right. We just waited there and we didn't know anything about the sport, but yeah, it was a big siege and it was a big deal, you know, and but it was, we just wanted it so bad.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
it cracks me up.
Right. I mean, you feel a little envious of that, Evan, when you hear about things happening first. I mean, I always feel like, and
it, how do you know it was first? Well, because they blasted the
rock. It had just been created.
Well, exactly.
I luckily got to do some first things. I mean, there really is unlimited potential in Alaska. But now you just have to be, it's who's willing to go the farthest.
It's more work.
Yeah, it's more work now. You have to get out, you have to go farther away.
Right.
Deeper in the mountains but there's lifetimes of adventure to be had.
Right.
Well, and there's a whole thing now that where somebody will post a picture online of a mountain and then everybody will seize that picture and says, oh, I've got to climb that. I want to, and then a race is on, to be the first one to climb
it. I actually just saw something on social media from a Canadian magazine. They posted four unclimbed faces in the Canadian Rockies and they said, who's going to go climb these? And, you know.
Right.
People are going to go climb them now because they're...
Dude, I mean, does that competitive aspect mean anything to you? I mean, is that like a part of your DNA in terms of how you view this? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was part of it. I mean, it's not the driver or anything completely, but it was definitely part because it was in competitive sports and I think there's you want, you know, and a desire is both, you know, it's got its downside, but you got to have that. I want it really badly.
Yeah.
You know?
So there's this, there's the goal.
Well, the other thing was everybody, like Emily said, where we found these routes were on this topo maps, and you'd search and find, you know, the ones with the tightest topographic lines and figure out and do the research and find out who, you know, if it done been climbed before. But we would go after these things and hold this list very close to your chest, and so
nobody else gets it.
Exactly,
right?
You're like a miner that's got this, you know, this little gold stash, and you don't want anybody else, or a fisherman. Uh-huh. You don't want to really invite them in. That's one of the differences. Is there's a lot more openness about that stuff, and but. Man, I wouldn't tell. Until I decided I was done, I wasn't going to tell anybody what I had found.
I actually remember chatting with Charlie probably in like 1997. I was probably 21 at the time, and I remember asking, you know, Charlie was hinting, "Oh, I'm going to go. I got this thing." I'm like, "Where are you going to go?" He's like, "I'm not going to tell you. You'll find out after I do it."
Right,
right. That's cool. But I mean, it's also an insight into the personality of the mountain climber, right? Is that some people are just satisfied to just go across the mountain, or just like, well, why would I care about going up there? But like the goal, you know, wanting to achieve that goal is a really important part of this sport.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah, the goal oriented aspect. It's not stopping to smell the flowers. It's getting up there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it comes down to being a really personal thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure Charlie would agree with me, but you know, the lessons that you learn about yourself in the mountains, you know, how you deal with adversity. How you deal with fear, how you deal with acceptance when things don't go the way you want them to. I mean, these are all things that I learned at a very young age in the mountains. You know, some of those lessons were pretty traumatic. They were formative experiences, and that's what makes it so special to me. Is just the learning that comes with it, and like I said before, just the close bonds between partners.
Without the adventure, you don't learn those lessons about yourself, and so that's a part of that interesting dichotomy of putting yourself out there. Yeah. Well, it's Outdoor Explorer. We are talking about mountain climbing and the mountain climbing community in Alaska with Charlie Cicera and Evan Phillips. We're going to take a short break and come back. In the second half, we're going to pull out some of those stories make it so interesting, some of those past climbs. And then we're also going to talk about some of the skills and techniques that, you know, those of us who are not mountain climbers might not know about that make it possible. So please stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking today about the mountain climbing community in Alaska. My guests are Charlie Cicera, who's been doing it for many decades and is still at it, and Evan Phillips, who is also a climber and is starting a new podcast called The Fern Mine, which is going to be airing soon. Part of this is telling stories about things you've done, experiences you've had, going out into the wilderness and bringing back adventures that mean something to you and you hope mean something to others. And sometimes maybe you don't even want to tell these stories to people who are not into the sport because you sound like you're bragging or you just, you know, Charlie was just sharing that essentially in the sort of the old time climbing, that wasn't part of the culture. It's sort of keep it to yourself, right? Which is quite different today with social media. But I want to get into some of these stories and some of the, maybe one of the ways to get at it is to think about climbs that were formative to you in terms of how you developed as a person and as a climber. And I know, Charlie, you were starting, as you said, just as a kid going out and attempting things and not knowing much. Were there some key moments or key experiences that sort of helped you develop and sort of know yourself and know what you were capable of?
There were, each one, there would be some sort of learning on it. I think that where first place that I saw it all sort of come together, because you had vision of the route, your technical skills, sort of your courage, your fitness, and the partner all in alignment. The first time I really felt that the potential was with Bob Dugan and I climbed the west face of Carpathian, which is down on the Skookum Glacier, and we and there's a gray wacky extrusion that comes out of the face, and it's 15 to 20 feet wide that runs for like 3,000 feet, and we had seen it but never been physically on it, and we did that in I think it was 84, and it was about somewhere around 30 pitches, and we did it in the afternoon with lunch, and we just took a 7 mil rope and a handful of gear and just let go of the bottom. The whole trick to those type of alpine climbs was having the confidence that it would all work out, and you just let go of the bottom and commit to going over the top. And so that one was, we went really quickly, and I think the route was repeated once since that. Well, only a week later, actually, McGivern and another friend. So. But seeing it come together, because it's the and then the flow that comes with that that experience.
I like that let go of the bottom, because that's kind of a good lesson for life, right? I mean, that's how you accomplish things.
It gets really easy as soon as you realize you can't go back.
Right. Well, but you've also highlighted this word of courage and fear. That's mm-hmm. Is that an inherent part of the sport, do you think?
And well, it's about the control of those emotions and compartmentalizing it and having the it's taxing over the long time of your life. If you do these hard experiences, they're harder to recover from. You need to kind of go away and then come back and sort of build up your internal armor to experience it. And I think in the end of the day that I ultimately ran out of courage before I ran out of physical capacity to do these kind of climbs. I mean, it was because it was the nature of the type of climbing that we were interested in that there was a lot of risk in them, both emotional, physical, and success, all the qualities.
Was there an incident or a trip that made that switch happen where you didn't really want to take the risk anymore?
No, I think it was cumulative. It's more like lead poisoning. It's like that's enough.
When is my number going to come up? In other words,
well, no, the number was always up. It was just, did you have it together to to be cool-headed and have the confidence. Because a big part of what we did, what we developed as kids, was the confidence that you would be okay, and that you could, that no matter what was going on, you could figure out how to get yourself out of there and go home. It wasn't that you weren't dependent on anyone else to do that. And so, like, when I was on Augusta in 2002, it was, and we were, Jack Tackle got clipped with a rock with rockfall and broke his neck and his back, and I had to rappel off the wall and get to our tent and finally get to a cell phone, or not a cell, but a satellite phone. And the notion, but in deep in my sort of heart and sort of belief, was that if it took walking across the glacier to Kewaunee or all the way to Seattle, that it would just do it, you know, that you have that confidence. But soon as the event is over, or that the pressure is off, it's emotionally very, very it's hard, you know.
That's when your mind starts going through the scenarios of what could have happened.
No, if you, I mean, in that one, it was...
Afterwards, I mean.
Well, no, it's not what would have happened. It's like, can imagine telling people that you lost your best friend.
Mm-hmm.
What, and that kind of stuff. You know, it's not about you or happening to you. It's the consequences of these decisions and how you've hurt other people.
And you have to finish that story. So what happened?
Well, I was able to get to the sat phone, called my Siri, said, call Daryl Miller. This is just like Malcolm Daly on Thunder Mountain, and we need the Llama. And
which is a high-altitude helicopter.
And then Daryl contacted Lloyd Fries at Kewaunee, and they got permission for the U.S. military to basically invade Canada in about an hour, and the 210th Rescue Squadron flew down there, and it took a couple tries, but they were able to longline Dave Schumann and collected Jack from the wall, and it was a pretty amazing bit of flying.
So
and
he was hanging on the wall or something?
Yeah, he was. I had tied him into a... the tent, and would cut a ledge, and so it was a 60 degree slope that inside of a back of a couloir, mm-hmm. that he was attached to. So, and it was a big deal. It was a really big deal from respect that what the 210th did and the skill of the pilot, and I think it was Rick Watson, I think was his name, but it was that was. Very, very heavy experience.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
So, Evan, I want to ask you the same question, just to elicit some stories of your climbing experience, that the climbs or the outings that really formed you or influenced your skills as a climber or even your personality as a human being.
For me, it was I would consider myself a Chugach climber. It was kind of my backyard park, and so everybody would talk about the rock being really crappy and all the stuff you go climbing the Alaska Range. Well, I ice climbed before I ever rock climbed. I swung ice tools before I ever technically rock climbed. So I was comfortable in these Chugach Mountains and comfortable doing snow and ice and rock routes, and it was a slow progression for me. I was careful. I would say, well, I'm going to go climb Ptarmigan Peak today by the south face. I did that. Okay, I'm going to go climb the North Couloir of Ptarmigan next week with a buddy. 2 weeks later, I'm going to ride my bike from home. I'll ride up all the way up there, back there, all solo. It was mm-hmm. incremental for me, and I taught myself how to do it by doing it, but by doing it, I guess, kind of methodically. I was not a bold climber. I was never the strongest climber. My partners were the strong climbers. My skills were being able to be a good teammate, being able to kick steps up snow gullies and carry a heavy pack and help out with the camp chores. But when it came to leading the technical pitches, I handed the rack and the rope over and said, you take the lead. I'll give you a good belay. And that was the way I contributed. I'm not saying I didn't do some hard leads. Mm-hmm. I did some hard, you know, I scared myself many times, but it was incremental for me. I turned around a lot on mountains. There was multiple peaks in the Chugach that would take me. Three was the lucky number for me. I went back and tried back the South Fork of Eagle River in 1996, the north face of Calliope Mountain, which is almost a 7,000-foot peak. You know, I went back there, hiked 10 miles back there. We looked at the conditions, started up it. It didn't feel safe, so we turned around. I went back there later in the summer and soloed up the face and made it up to the ridge, but an avalanche had ripped down to the right, so I just went down the backside. I was scared. And then the next year, I went back with my buddy Carl, and the conditions were good, and we climbed the face and made it. So, it is an incremental learning of lessons. And, you know, as I continued, you know, my skill set got bigger and my knowledge got bigger, and we would just apply that to bigger and bigger things. And one thing to note for me is I actually injured myself in March of 2002. So I actually, that was a career-ending injury. So I actually haven't climbed in 15 years now. But that was all I did for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sure, you know, I look back on it now and, you know, in that trajectory I was headed, I was wanting to do bigger and bigger and bigger things. So, you know, maybe it's okay that I did mm-hmm. it for 10 years. And
what was that? What was your injury?
You know, it's pretty benign thing. I just tore a muscle rock climbing, and it just turned into a chronic injury, but it's prevented me from being able to do that stuff. Mm-hmm. I wish I could say, oh, I took a big fall or got caught, but it's been a big, I was talking to Charlie before we came here and just talking about how at 27 years old, you know, I had to learn how to deal with acceptance and learn how to deal with, like, get my ego squashed, you know.
Yeah, that's rough.
But, you know.
Well, when you look back on your sort of climbing resume, do you have some certain things that you think of as being, like, yeah, the thing, I'm really glad I was able to do that?
Absolutely. I mean, it's countless trips. You know, it could be, one that really stands out for me is in April of 1999, my friend Carl and I, we got dropped off by my dad at the Matanuska Glacier, and we had spotted this face on a contour map. It basically was about a mile high face, and the contour lines are really tight. And we did some research, and the mountain didn't even have a name. I found out later that it was called Icing Peak, and that it had been climbed one time in the 70s by, I think, Brian Okinek from the other side. But we saw this beautiful ridge on the contour map, and we said, let's go do this. So we packed 10 days of food and fuel, and it took us 3 days of pretty desperate travel up the Matanuska Glacier. The second day, we found fresh brown bear tracks, and we followed those brown bear. We said, let's follow these tracks, because we were having a hard time navigating through the glacier because of so many crevasses. So let's follow these tracks because they look like they're headed.
He knows where he's going.
Yeah, the bear, you know, we'll just follow these tracks. We followed those tracks for 10 miles up the glacier, literally to the base of this climb. Uh-huh. And those tracks cut to the east and went over a 10,000-foot pass.
Wow.
Back towards Mount Marcus Baker, which is the highest mountain in Chugach Mountains. So that was in just the approach. It took us 4 days to get there. The next day, we did the first ascent of the north ridge of Icing Peak, which is just stunningly beautiful, aesthetic climb. And then after that, we did a traverse over an unnamed pass over into the headwaters of Glacier Creek. And we were going to try to climb Mount Sergeant Robinson, which is about a 10,000-foot mountain. And we had just had really scary crevasse glacier travel, and mentally I was torched when we got to the bottom of this thing. And Carl, you know, my buddy Carl wanted to go, and I said, no, I'm not going, I've had enough. And we ended up hiking out Glacier Creek, but that was a, you know, 10-day trip. We did the first ascent of this beautiful mountain, did a We circumnavigated, 70 miles of pretty uncharted territory, and it was just a great adventure.
Yeah.
You know, I was like 24 years old.
Cool. It's Outdoor Explorer. That was Evan Phillips who's just talking. He's got a new podcast called The Fern Line, and Charlie Cicera is also with me, and we're talking about mountain climbing and the mountain climbing community. My name is Charles Wolforth. One thing that just is a practical question that keeps occurring to me is, how do you know if somebody's climbed one of these obscure mountains before, right? There's so many mountains all over the place. Has somebody got a list somewhere of what has been climbed?
You know, honestly, knowing what I know now, that stuff really doesn't matter to me.
Uh-huh.
But back then, in the mid-90s even, there was more people doing it when... That was kind of when climbing started to get popular. But you do research, and
asking around town,
basically. You figure
basically.
It out.
Yeah.
But it's...
The American Alpine Club keeps a written record of, these scents around the world. And then there was the MCA would have the reports, But the community was so small here, so it was easy. And the people, mm-hmm. so
who could have done it?
Yeah. That's a big one there, because there's some people that there's some really hard things up here, and there's only a handful of people that are possible to do it,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's pretty easy.
Yeah,
you must have met some of these climbers coming from other continents who are coming to climb here and who have different styles. The sort of the European fast attack, so it sort of took Alaska by storm at one point. Was that interesting for you, Charlie, meeting some of those folks?
Very much so. We had a house on 10th and H, and we were sort of the locus for people coming through town. And one of the funniest things was this Slovenian guy. I'd see him in I don't know if it was in Talkeetna or someplace, and he goes, "I know you." What? And I know you. I've stayed at your house. And I'm like, I have never met this guy in my life, right? And so it was Miroslav Schmid. And, with Jean-Marc Bovan, he was one of the first extreme skiers. And just they were fabulous, they would come through, and they wanted to have an experience in Alaska, and so we would always open the house up to them staying there. And then out in the Wrangles, one of the guys that really opened this up was Rudy Humberger. He was a photographer and a Swiss mountaineer, and done a lot of climbing all over the planet, and he's the one, we used to call him Ropeless Rudy, but he's the one that showed us how to really go quickly out in the Wrangles, and it was the reduction of weight and uncomplicated gear, and it was mostly a little bit like what we did here locally, but applying it to the bigger range. And and it was risky, but you could climb these big peaks with very, very little gear, and mm-hmm. So he really helped. And we kind of developed our own ideas about how to do it,
So there's some transfer back and forth between the different continents. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about the gear that you carry or would carry, and I'm also curious about how that's evolved over the years.
Yeah. When I first started, it was the change between the wool and the synthetics, and mm-hmm. so that was a big difference. And then the synthetic boots, and later years later, I was working with Vask and these other and Technica, and we built the first fabric boots and double boots and things like that. So the most recently, I'm just gonna, from the most recent experience is I can't believe how good these ice screws are right now, because I just did a handful of climbs this winter, and they are so easy to use that it's just they're going like butter. And when we would have wrenches or separate tools that you'd lever on, or like you were trying to, you know, open a hatch, right? It wasn't possible to do it with one hand. You needed two hands to put the damn things in. So, yeah, that just blows me away. And then the ice tools have evolved, and we build, but right now I just can't get over how good those ice screws are.
Yeah, and it seems to me like the gear for withstanding extremely cold temperatures has improved, like, you know, beyond.
Not really.
No,
it's
no.
Things have gotten lighter.
They've gotten lighter, but not, they're not warmer.
I hear.
No,
you. Okay.
Because for the most part.
It had to be warmer, you couldn't have done it. But I mean, getting lighter and more.
It's the lightness is a big change, but mm-hmm. yeah.
And I know we're talking about gear, but you know, one of the things that Charlie talked about in the episode that we did on the Fernline is he talked about what's also allowing people to push it more. It's not only the gear, but the weather routing, being able to understand is technology, essentially.
Right.
Technology is allowing outdoor folks and climbers and alpinists to do things, take bigger risks in the big mountains, mm-hmm. because there's more knowledge now. You can buy.
You know what's coming weather-wise.
Yeah, so. You can buy a weather forecast.
And also, with GPS now, I mean, I got another big trip, but you know, I literally have been stuck 40 miles from a road in complete whiteout, out of food, having to navigate with compass taking compass bearings. You don't have to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when we were in the Wrangells, we would fly or go to these peaks. We would put in waypoints with the GPS. Basically, the thing was, whenever the technology moved, we took it, right? And so when I went to Denali in 83, my dad gave me an aircraft emergency locator beacon, mm-hmm. right? That was one tool. And then later it was, you know, the GPSs. And like the GPSs with across those glaciers, because you can't see where you're going to be going. So we had to put waypoints in. Mm-hmm. Right now, now like in Patagonia, the first time, the only time I went down there, it was when the transfer to digital cameras, and so you would just say, where'd you leave the pack, and you'd leave them. You say, I left it right here, which is in an image,
yeah.
right? What was the snow conditions like? It was just like this, and so you would record, and you have immediate feedback of where you're going. But the in Alaska, you can only think about climbing in context of as aviation, development of aviation, and the skills and mm-hmm. the perspectives of the aviators, because they've come together. And so now you talk to Paul Roderick, and he's already flown by the route, and he can land there, and you know, and there's instead of a 10-day approach that Evan just talked about,
right.
you just land at the bottom, right?
It's like
with your in Alaska, the unique thing is about the weather, which is in 3 to 5 days you can kind of beat the weather, but in a week there's another system,
right.
and you're not going to beat it. So you know you're. And so when you and basically the bottom line is when the weather's good, alpine climbing is easy, mm-hmm. right?
Easier.
It's easy because you don't carry the weight. You don't carry the burden of what happens when it goes bad.
Right.
Right.
Right. And if you can count on it.
Alpine climbing's not easy.
So we've got a few minutes left, and I want to bring in another issue here, which is the ethics of dangerous outdoor activities. And it's something that I've found as someone who's lived in Alaska all my life and lost plenty of friends in dangerous activities and plane crashes and everything else. And when you lose somebody, you think like, well, why was it important enough for that person to be doing that, right? Because it's not only them losing their life, it's all, you know, their family and all the other impacts and the rescuers sometimes risking their lives to go out and find somebody. And I just was interested just to throw it out there, because you guys have, I'm sure, thought about this, that, you know, it's an activity. It's a little bit different from being like a cyclist, right? Where you're, there's no, that life and death issue isn't there. In this sport, the life and death issue really is there. And, you know, I guess if you're a kid, you might take it lightly, but most of us would not. And Charlie, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm trying to get my head around the question, which is,
when you risk your life, you're for an activity, you're not the only one who would lose, right?
If you very
fail.
Much so.
Yeah, and
yeah.
So thinking about others and thinking about the impact of what you're doing.
Well,
is that something that was important to you when you were doing this?
Well, we it turns out that most of the people that we knew as climbers and respected were very, very self-sufficient and very conscious of that responsibility to, you know, their family and parents. And so, everybody really worked really hard to, tell them where you're going, when you're going to mm-hmm. be back, all those kinds of basic lessons when you're in, in right. junior high school. So, it's not a, I think that's an individual choice, right? And there are not, I know a number of people that when they got into having families that their choices changed and that's, you have to respect that. But our attitude and most Alaskans' attitude is that nobody's coming to get you. And so you start with that perspective and then you make the choices that you can and then you use the best technology and the best information you can. That's why we're just talking about the progression, in radios or weather mm-hmm. routing or aircraft or gear or what, because right. those are things that you can control, right? Mm-hmm. But
I kind of feel like that's maybe changing, that nobody's coming to get you attitude is changing a bit these days, that at least some people seem to think there's a safety net.
Maybe for some people, mm-hmm. But when you, coming from the perspective that Charlie and I came from, there really was a mentality of, we are responsible for rescuing ourselves, and clearly, things happen. You have to deal with those things when they happen. But for me, it's something that you're very proud of. You take pride in being self-sufficient. You take pride in knowing what your limits are, and I certainly had respect, and Charlie does too, about, you don't go into something, you go into something saying, we're going to manage this and deal with it. And since I've been in climbing, it's been a long time, and it has changed. There's people doing base jumping now. There's all these sports that kind of are connected to climbing. There's more free soloing now. And these are ethical questions that are going to continue
Some of which are just courting danger.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. And I don't know how I feel about that. Mm-hmm. I think I'm kind of with Charlie. Is that I feel like it's everybody's individual decision. I have no problem with Alex Honnold going out and free soloing. I have empathy for him. I understand on some level that. If you're not a climber, it's hard to understand why somebody would do something like that. But I would argue that he has to do that. That's his path in life, mm-hmm. and the people who are pushing the limits are that's how things happen on the planet. People say things are impossible. Other people say things. No, this isn't impossible, and I'm going to do it. And that's how things progress.
Yeah.
And there's ethics involved in that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I want to thank both of you guys for being here. It's been a really fun hour, and I've learned a lot. Charlie Cicera, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Charles.
And Evan Phillips, the new podcast is called The Firn Line, F-I-R-N Line.
Yeah.
You find it on iTunes or anywhere you get your podcast.
Yeah, it's on iTunes, and I got a website, thefirnline.com.
Fantastic. Well, thanks. And the show is Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Woolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.